Think about this for a second. In 2022, over a quarter of all opioid overdose deaths in the entire United States shared one specific hidden origin point.
Yeah, it's wild when you actually look at the numbers.
Right. More than 21,000 fatal overdoses didn't just happen randomly. They happened to people during that immediate window right after they walked out the doors of a local jail or prison.
Exactly.
I mean, 27% of the national crisis can be traced right back to the concrete walls of our correctional system.
It really is a staggering statistic. And, you know, it completely shatters this illusion that what happens behind bars stays behind bars.
Oh, for sure.
Because the reality is that 95% of people who are incarcerated eventually come home, and they bring the systemic failures or the successes of the prison healthcare system right back into our communities.
Which brings us to what we're doing today. Welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive.
Yeah.
Today, we are taking you inside a massive parallel healthcare ecosystem that operates entirely in the shadows.
Yeah, it's basically a world walled off by razor wire.
Exactly. A system where a doctor in one state's prison often has absolutely no idea what the doctor in the next state is doing. So our mission today is to explore this sprawling, siloed world.
And we've got our hands on a highly specialized, exclusive source to do it.
We do. We are looking at the inaugural issue of Core Pearls, published in May 2026. It's a clinical and policy briefing from the American College of Correctional Physicians.
And reading through it, I mean, you immediately realize that correctional medicine is not just some isolated niche.
Right.
It is the absolute front line of American public health. The briefing lays out how deeply intertwined this hidden system is with the clinics and the emergency rooms in your own neighborhood.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we aren't just talking about, you know, taking temperatures and handing out aspirin here.
Definitely not.
We are talking about billions of your taxpayer dollars, fierce constitutional rights battles, and massive public health impacts. So let's start with something that makes the connection between the inside and the outside incredibly obvious.
Infectious diseases.
Yes. Because concrete walls might keep people in, but they absolutely do not keep viruses contained.
They really don't. In fact, a correctional facility functions almost like a biosphere. You have overcrowding, poor ventilation, and just a constantly churning population.
A perfect storm, basically.
Exactly. If you aren't aggressively monitoring for infectious diseases, that environment becomes an accelerant.
And the Core Pearls briefing has this chilling example of how fast things can unravel. There was this tuberculosis outbreak in a Washington State prison cluster recently.
Yeah, the numbers on that one were rough.
25 active TB cases and 244 conversions. And just for you listening, a conversion basically means someone went from testing negative to testing positive for the TB bacteria.
Meaning they were exposed and infected.
Right. And why did this happen? Because their annual screening was paused during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Exactly. They stopped actively looking for it, and within 2 years, transmission just exploded.
Which is terrifying.
It is. It perfectly illustrates the fragility of the system. In a closed environment, routine screening isn't just a bureaucratic checkbox. I mean, it is the primary structural defense.
Because if TB spreads in a cell block,
it's going to spread to the guards, the staff, and eventually the families of the people being released.
Which naturally brings us to an even bigger viral threat mentioned in the source, and that's hepatitis C.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge issue.
It's a bloodborne virus that is highly prevalent in incarcerated populations, and the current medical treatments are absolute miracles, right? They actually cure the virus.
But they are unbelievably expensive, prohibitively expensive, really.
Right. A single treatment course of Hep C drugs, like Mavyret or Epclusa, can cost anywhere from roughly $26,000 to $74,000 per patient.
Which creates a total nightmare for a state prison budget.
Totally. Imagine a warden or a state medical director looking at a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
If you have, say, 2,000 inmates who are positive for Hep C, treating all of them at $74,000 a pop heap.
It will bankrupt a state budget instantly.
Instantly. So historically, what do?
Yeah.
They ration the care.
Yeah.
They only treat the sickest people.
But the briefing highlights this proposed federal legislation, the Cure Hepatitis C Act of 2025, or S.1941.
Yeah, and this part is fascinating. They are proposing what is basically a Netflix model for procuring these drugs.
The subscription procurement model? It is a brilliant administrative pivot that completely bypasses the rationing problem.
Right, because instead of paying per pill or per patient, the government just pays a flat negotiated fee to the pharmaceutical companies.
And in exchange, they get unlimited access to the cure for state and local correctional systems, Medicaid, and the Indian Health Service.
It's exactly like you pay one flat fee for your streaming service and can binge as many shows as you want.
Exactly. The prisons can treat as many patients as they need to without the per-patient sticker shock. You literally wipe the virus out of the population.
And the medical innovation happening inside isn't just in how we pay for the drugs, right? It's in the actual delivery mechanisms.
Oh, for sure. Look at the new FDA-approved injectable PIP for HIV prevention. It's called lenacapavir, which goes by the brand name Yes2Go.
Now, this detail really stood out to me. It costs roughly $28,000 a year, but the key is that it's only two injections a year.
Which is huge. Think about the logistics of a transient county jail population.
I can only imagine.
It is pure chaos. People are moving between cell blocks, going to court appearances, being released on bail, getting transferred to state facilities, going through security shakedowns.
The constant movement.
Right. So trying to ensure a patient takes a daily oral pill for HIV without missing a dose in that environment, it is nearly impossible.
And if they miss doses, the virus mutates and they build resistance.
Exactly. But two subcutaneous injections a year, that is a logistical game changer. You don't have to worry about them missing a daily pill while they're in transit.
Treating people while they're stationary, while they're literally a captive audience, seems like such an obvious strategy. I mean, you have them right there.
What's fascinating here is how treating sexually transmitted infections and HIV inside jails is actually a primary defense for the broader community's health.
Oh, completely.
The briefing mentions using DoxyPep, that's the antibiotic doxycycline taken shortly after exposure, and it's used to drastically reduce bacterial STIs like syphilis and chlamydia.
And they pair that with opt-out screening, right?
Yes, where everyone is tested unless they specifically refuse. Utilizing these new long-acting treatments while someone is incarcerated is one of the most effective public health interventions we have.
Because if you don't treat them inside, you are essentially guaranteeing that an untreated infection is walking out the front gates and into the local community.
Precisely. You treat the individual to fulfill their medical needs, yes, but you are actively shielding the community they are about to return to.
So treating them while they're inside makes total sense for infections. But there's a flip side to that release window. Being inside might temporarily halt the virus, but it creates a massive hidden vulnerability when it comes to addiction.
Which brings us back to that terrifying statistic we started the show with.
The overdose epidemic.
Right. The medical literature points to the immediate post-release window as incredibly deadly, primarily due to opioid use disorder.
Why is that specific window so dangerous?
Well, when someone is incarcerated, they obviously lose access to their drug of choice. And because of that, their physiological tolerance to opioids drops significantly.
It essentially resets.
Exactly. So if they relapse upon release, which happens frequently due to the sheer stress of reentry, and they use the exact same amount of the drug they used prior to their arrest,
their body just can't handle it anymore.
Right. Their body can no longer handle it. It is very often fatal.
And that's how we get to that 2026 addiction analysis from the briefing. In 2022, 21,784 people released from U.S. jails and prisons died of opioid overdoses.
27% of the entire national crisis.
It is a massive structural failure, but the briefing points out that it's a solvable one, right?
It is entirely preventable. The source cites a 2025 pilot study published in the New England Journal of Medicine across seven county jails in Massachusetts.
And what did they find?
It proved that providing medication for opioid use disorder, or MOUD, which refers to drugs like buprenorphine and methadone while a person is incarcerated, significantly lowers their risk of post-release fatal overdose.
Because it stabilizes the brain's receptors.
Exactly. It also lowers all-cause mortality and even reduces the chances of them being reincarcerated.
Okay, wait. Let me play devil's advocate for the listener here. If the Massachusetts pilot study showed that methadone and buprenorphine work so incredibly well at stopping post-release overdoses, why aren't jails just scaling that up nationwide? Problem solved, right?
Well, it would be a massive step forward if the illicit drug supply hadn't violently shifted out from under us. Have you heard of xylazine?
Also known as Trank. The briefing highlights it as a major emerging threat. But wait, if xylazine is in the opioid supply, does giving them standard opioid withdrawal meds like methadone even work?
That is the exact clinical nightmare these facilities are facing right now. To clarify the mechanism from the source material, standard opioid medications are no longer enough because xylazine is not an opioid.
Oh, wow.
Right. It is an alpha-2 adrenergic agonist.
Okay, for those of us who aren't pharmacists, what does that actually mean?
It basically means it's a heavy-duty central nervous system depressant. It's actually used by veterinarians as an animal tranquilizer.
Jeez.
So if someone is withdrawing from a fentanyl-xylazine mixture, the methadone or buprenorphine will treat the opioid withdrawal. But it does absolutely nothing for the xylazine.
And xylazine withdrawal is brutal, I'm assuming.
It is. It causes severe panic-level anxiety, dangerous hypertension, agitation, and even seizures.
So you need an entirely different set of medications to manage it.
Exactly. It requires a completely different pharmacological management strategy, typically using medications like clonidine to manage those autonomic nervous system symptoms.
That sounds incredibly complicated for a jail to handle.
Think about what this means for a local county jail. When a police officer brings someone in for a minor offense, the booking and intake process used to just be fingerprinting and paperwork.
Right. Fairly straightforward.
Now, because of xylazine, that intake process is instantly a highly volatile, medically complex, critical care scenario. You are essentially running a triage unit right in the booking bay.
And providing that level of complex, nuanced, intensive care is incredibly difficult. And honestly, it's wildly expensive.
It really is.
Which leads us to a grim reality. Because it's so hard and costly, facilities sometimes fail to provide it. Or, due to state politics, they outright refuse to provide certain types of care. And that brings us to the explosive landscape of correctional litigation.
It does. Now, before we dive into this next segment, we are about to get into some heavy constitutional law regarding gender-affirming care and IC attention.
Yes, and we need to be very clear here. Just a quick note for your listening. We're looking at this strictly through the lens of the legal mechanics and policy facts laid out in our source, the Corporal's Briefing.
Exactly. We aren't here to take political sides, and we are not endorsing the viewpoints of the plaintiffs, the defendants, or the lawmakers on the left or the right.
Right. Our goal is simply to map out the reality of how the federal courts are currently handling these highly contentious medical claims. We are just impartially reporting the legal and policy facts.
Completely. And the courts are highly, highly active right now, particularly around transgender health care.
Yeah, the briefing details a federal case called Kingdom v. Trump, where a judge ordered the Federal Bureau of Prisons to continue hormone therapy for roughly 2,000 transgender patients currently in its custody.
And at the state level, there's a case called Doe v. Carr, where a federal district court permanently enjoined or basically blocked Georgia's SB 185.
And that was a state law that attempted to ban hormone therapy in state prisons, right?
Yes. And the legal framework driving these decisions is crucial to understand. The federal courts evaluate these cases through the lens of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment.
Exactly. Decades ago, the Supreme Court established that if a prison system shows deliberate indifference to an inmate's serious medical needs, it violates that amendment.
And so the current wave of litigation is wrestling with how that specific legal standard applies to gender dysphoria.
Right. And whether there is a constitutional obligation to provide or maintain treatments like hormone therapy under that deliberate indifference standard.
And the sheer volume of litigation extends way beyond state prisons into federal detention as well. The briefing notes some incredibly concerning numbers regarding IC immigration and customs enforcement detention.
Yeah, the numbers there are really stark.
There have been 46 deaths in IC custody since January 2025. And what's particularly alarming from a medical oversight perspective is that 32 of those deaths involve the worsening of pre-existing medical conditions.
And all of this is occurring amidst severe medical staffing shortages. When a system consistently fails to meet those Eighth Amendment standards, when the constitutional violations become entrenched, and people are dying from preventable or mismanaged conditions despite years of warnings and lawsuits, the courts have a tool of last resort.
Then what is that?
It's known in the legal world as a structural remedy.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because a structural remedy isn't just a fine or a slap on the wrist, is it?
Not all.
In February 2026, there was this massive case in Arizona called Jensen v. Thornell. And a federal judge basically looked at the state and said, enough is enough.
Yeah, the state had failed for over a decade to fix its unconstitutional medical and mental health care.
So the federal court literally stripped the state of Arizona of its control over its own prison health care. They ordered the appointment of a federal receiver to completely take over the entire Arizona prison medical and mental health system.
You really have to pause and absorb the gravity of that.
It's massive.
It is the most significant structural remedy in correctional medicine in over a decade. I mean, imagine a federal court coming in, overriding a sovereign state's authority, and forcibly taking the keys to an entire state agency's healthcare operation.
Just because they are so fundamentally incapable of providing baseline constitutional care.
Exactly. It highlights just how deep the systemic rot goes.
And it begs the question, why are these state systems buckling so badly? I mean, yes, the medical complexity with things like xylazine is rising, but there is also a massive demographic shift happening behind bars.
Right. The system is buckling under the weight of a rapidly graying population.
Combined with a private contractor market that is practically collapsing.
The geriatric crisis in prisons is profound. The briefing cites a projection that by 2030, one-third of the entire U.S. prison population will be over the age of 50.
Now, you might be thinking, 50 doesn't sound elderly. But prison years are vastly different from normal years, aren't they?
Oh, entirely. The physiological aging process is rapidly accelerated due to chronic stress, prior trauma, substance use, and years of limited healthcare access.
So a 50-year-old in prison often has the physiological profile of a 7-year-old on the outside.
Exactly. Look at Illinois. The average age of death in their custody is just 56.
Wow.
And a recent report showed that out of 488 inmates who died there, 404 of them died without receiving any hospice care whatsoever.
It forces a brutal reckoning with what the prison system is actually designed to do versus what it is currently doing. I mean, a prison is designed for security and punishment.
Right. It is completely unequipped to operate as a network of incredibly under-resourced nursing homes.
But states are finally starting to react to this demographic reality. Maryland just passed a law, SB 181, which allows for geriatric parole consideration for inmates over the age of 65 who have served at least 20 years of their sentence.
Which is a start.
But for those who don't get parole and remain inside, their complex geriatric care has to be funded, staffed, and managed. And almost all of this care across the country is outsourced to private, for-profit healthcare contractors.
And that private contractor market is currently experiencing immense systemic turbulence.
Turbulence is putting it mildly. The Cora Pearl's briefing lists a parade of financial disasters for these private equity-backed companies.
Yeah, the dominoes are really falling there.
Yes, Scare. A major contractor filed for bankruptcy after getting hit with a $307 million jury verdict. WellPath, another giant in the space, just emerged from Chapter 11 reorganization.
And NAFCARE was banned from operating in New York for 5 years and had to pay an $875,000 settlement.
And that's on top of massive individual payouts we are seeing across the country, like a $9.8 million settlement for mental health neglect in South Carolina and $2.75 million for a jail suicide in Washington.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, well, think about the operational chaos this creates on the ground. When a massive healthcare contractor goes bankrupt or has their state contract terminated overnight due to a lawsuit, the facility doesn't just stop needing doctors.
Right. Imagine if your local hospital's entire HR department, their pharmacy supply chain, and their IT network just evaporated into thin air because of a corporate bankruptcy.
That would be a disaster.
The patients are still in the beds needing their insulin. The psychiatric patients still need their daily medications to stay stable.
Exactly. But the infrastructure to give it to them just disappeared.
Right.
The electronic health records go dark. The credentialing of the nurses is suddenly in limbo. The pharmacy deliveries stop.
It's terrifying.
It is an incredibly fragile, profit-driven foundation trying to support what is constitutionally mandated life or death medical care.
It really is a high-stakes ecosystem. We're talking about constitutional law, billion-dollar private equity contracts, and severe public health crises, all locked behind a wall that most of society never looks behind.
But the barrier between the inside and the outside is getting thinner.
Especially when it comes to how we pay for all of this. The briefing notes a massive policy shift that started in 2026. New federal laws now require states to suspend, rather than terminate, Medicaid coverage for people when they are incarcerated.
And that is a fundamental seismic shift in public health policy. Historically, the moment you were booked into jail, you lost your Medicaid entirely.
And trying to re-enroll upon release could take months of bureaucratic red tape.
Right. And that delay is exactly what created that deadly gap in care we talked about earlier with the overdose crisis.
That's suspending it.
That means the coverage is essentially just paused, and it can be immediately reactivated the very moment they step out the door. It explicitly, legally links jail healthcare to community healthcare systems.
So what does this all mean? We've looked at the infectious disease incubators, the horrifying release day overdose statistics, the massive constitutional lawsuits over hormone therapy, and the crumbling private contractors trying to run geriatric wards.
This raises an important question. With Medicaid policies shifting to preserve continuous coverage and states actively using federal waivers to connect inmates directly to community care upon release, are U.S. jails and prisons inadvertently transforming into the largest, most expensive public health intervention centers in the entire country?
Wow. And if that is what they're becoming, it leaves us with this final thought for you to chew on. If we as taxpayers are already spending billions of dollars to treat the most complex medical, addiction, and psychological conditions inside a highly punitive, walled-off environment,
right,
might it be infinitely more effective and far cheaper to fund these exact same medical interventions in our communities before people end up behind bars in the first place?
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the hidden systems operating all around you, and we'll catch you next time.